Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz. Welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program that helps you learn everyday American English. It's Sunday, December 13th, 2015. It was on this day in 2003 that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was captured near his hometown of Tikrit. He had been hiding in a hole in the ground. He was hanged on December 30th, 2006. Today on the program, we have a fascinating report on six of the differences between American and British English. We think you will keep this story and listen to it over and over again. Then, as we always do on Sundays, we will bring you words and their stories. This week, we will tell you about the expression, burning your bridges. It means to act in a way that destroys any chance of returning to the way things were. When you burn your bridges, there is no going back. And finally, we will present People in America. This week, we will bring you part one of our story of the life of Sam Houston. He was a congressman, senator, governor, president of the Republic of Texas, and a hero. So you can see, we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. There is an old saying that America and Britain are two nations divided by a common language. No one knows exactly who said this, but it reflects the way many Brits feel about American English. One Brit has said to an American, "You don't speak English, you speak American." But are American and British English really so different? Jill Robbins, John Russell, and Claudia Milne are here to answer that question.
The most noticeable difference between American and British English is vocabulary. There are hundreds of everyday words that are different. For example, Brits call the front of a car the bonnet, while Americans call it the hood. Americans go on vacation,
while Brits go on holidays or holes.
New Yorkers live in apartments.
Londoners live in flats.
There are far more examples than we can talk about here. Fortunately, most Americans and Brits can usually guess the meaning through the context of a sentence.
There are a few grammatical differences between the two varieties of English. Let's start with collective nouns. We use collective nouns to refer to a group of individuals. In American English, collective nouns are singular. For example, staff refers to a group of employees. Band refers to a group of musicians. Team refers to a group of athletes. Americans would say,
"The band is good."
But in British English, collective nouns can be singular or plural. You might hear someone from Britain say,
"The team are playing tonight."
Or,
"The team is playing tonight."
Another grammar difference between American and British English relates to auxiliary verbs. Auxiliary verbs, also known as helping verbs, are verbs that help form a grammatical function. They help the main verb by adding information about time, modality, and voice. Let's look at the auxiliary verb shall. Brits sometimes use shall to express the future. For example,
"I shall go home now."
Americans know what shall means, but rarely use it in conversation. It seems very formal. Americans would probably use, "I will go home now." In question form, a Brit might say,
"Shall we go now?"
While an American would probably say, "Should we go now?" When Americans want to express a lack of obligation, they use the helping verb do with negative not, followed by need. "You do not need to come to work today." Brits drop the helping verb and contract not.
"You needn't come to work today."
You will also find some small differences with past forms of irregular verbs. The past tense of learn in American English is learned. British English has the option of learned or learnt. The same rule applies to dreamed and dreamt, burned and burnt, leaned and leant. Americans tend to use the ED ending. Brits tend to use the T ending. In the past participle form, Americans tend to use the EN ending for some irregular verbs. For example, an American might say, "I have never gotten caught," whereas a Brit would say,
"I have never got caught."
Americans use both got and gotten in the past participle. Brits only use got. Don't worry too much about these small differences in the past forms of irregular verbs. People in both countries can easily understand both ways, although Brits tend to think of the American way as incorrect.
A tag question is a grammatical form that turns a statement into a question. For example,
"The whole situation is unfortunate, isn't it?"
Or,
"You don't like him, do you?"
The tag includes a pronoun and its matching form of the verb be, have, or do. Tag questions encourage people to respond and agree with the speaker. Americans use tag questions too, but less often than Brits. You can learn more about tag questions on a previous episode of Everyday Grammar. There are hundreds of minor spelling differences between British and American English. You can thank American lexicographer Noah Webster for this. You might recognize Webster's name from the dictionary that carries his name. Noah Webster, an author, politician, and teacher, started an effort to reform English spelling in the late 1700s. He was frustrated by the inconsistencies in English spelling. Webster wanted to spell words the way they sounded. Spelling reform was also a way for America to show its independence from England. You can see Webster's legacy in the American spelling of words like color, honor, and labor. Webster dropped the letter U from these words to make the spelling match the pronunciation. Other Webster ideas failed, like a proposal to spell women as W-I-M-M-E-N. Since Webster's death in 1843, attempts to change spelling rules in American English have gone nowhere.
British and American English have far more similarities than differences, and some think the difference between American and British English is often exaggerated. The fact is, if you can understand one style, you can understand the other style. With the exception of some regional dialects, most Brits and Americans can understand each other without too much difficulty. They watch each other's TV shows, sing each other's songs, and read each other's books. They even make fun of each other's accents. Well, now it's time for the weekly VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Every language has common words that are used in uncommon ways. This week, Anna Mateo focuses on the word bridge.
A bridge is a structure that provides passage over something, such as a river, train tracks, a highway, or a deep, wide opening in the ground. The word bridge can also be used to join things you can't touch, such as cultures or activities. For example, you could say music and art can bridge cultures. And language can be a bridge between two people. But let's get back to the bridges you can actually cross or drive a tank over. Bridges often play an important role in warfare. An army that attacks across a river may decide to burn the bridge after crossing it. By burning the bridge, the army prevents its enemy from using it. However, the army also destroys its own chance to go back across the river. Burning a bridge leaves the army open to attack. The expression, burning your bridges, means to act in a way that destroys any chance of returning to the way things were. When you burn your bridges, there is no going back. Let's put this expression in the workplace. You decide to take a new job. Now, you must tell your boss you are leaving your current job. During that conversation, you tell him how much you hated your job, how much you hated working for him, and how glad you are to finally leave. You have just burned your bridge. You have destroyed your relationship with that boss. If things do not work out with your new job, there is no way on earth your old boss will take you back, ever. And you can also forget about any good recommendation. Burning your professional bridges can be foolish, or it can be a bold career move. It is even bolder if you do it in a public manner. For example, in 2014, a woman named Charlo Green was a reporter on a news television show in Anchorage, Alaska. One night, she reported on a business called the Alaska Cannabis Club. Cannabis is another word for marijuana. Marijuana is currently illegal in most U.S. states. At the end of her report, Green announced that she owned the Alaska Cannabis Club. She told the audience that she wanted to spend her time fighting for freedom and fairness, which begins with legalizing marijuana here in Alaska. Then she cursed, said she quit her job as a reporter, and walked off camera. Charlo Green completely burned her bridges with that news station, and probably every news station. no traditional media organization would ever take her back or give her a good job recommendation. But Green is okay with that. She said later in an interview that if she quit by politely giving 2 weeks' notice, nobody would know about the issue she really cares about. This brings us to another common expression using bridge. I will cross that bridge when I come to it. This expression means to not worry about a future problem, but rather deal with it when it happens.
When it came to dealing with the problem of quitting her job, Charlo Green certainly crossed that bridge when she came to it, and then she burnt it to the ground. In fact, people now mix these two expressions in a joking way. They say, "I'll burn that bridge when I come to it." And that's Words and Their Stories this week from VOA Learning English. It was written and narrated by Anna Mateo. Now it's time for People in America. Today, we tell the story of Sam Houston. He was a congressman, senator, governor, president of the Republic of Texas, and a hero. Here are Steve Ember and Phoebe Zimmerman to tell us more about him.
The United States was 17 years old when Sam Houston was born in Virginia in 1793. His father was a soldier during the Revolutionary War. After the war, he served as an officer in the state military forces of Virginia. Sam's mother took care of the family farm while her husband was busy with his duties. Sam's father died when the boy was 14 years old. Sam's mother had to sell the farm to pay the money her husband owed. She and the children moved west to Tennessee.
Life in Tennessee was not easy. Mrs. Houston and her children had to build a house and clear trees off the land. Sam did not like such hard work. His mother and brothers decided that the boy was not meant to be a farmer. They sent him to work in a store. Sam did not like this job any better than farming. One morning, he failed to go to work. Sam was gone for weeks. Then his mother heard that he was living with the Cherokee Indians. Sam's brothers found him at an Indian village. Sam refused to leave. He told his brothers that he loved the way the Indians lived. The Cherokee chief, Uluteka, accepted Sam as his son. Sam was 19 years old when he left the Indians to return to his own people.
The United States and Britain had begun fighting the War of 1812, and Sam Houston wanted to fight for his country. He left to join the forces of General Andrew Jackson. Houston fought in a battle against a group of Creek Indians who supported the British. He was wounded in the leg. Later in the fighting, General Jackson asked for someone to lead an attack against the Indians. Houston jumped up and led the attack. He was hit by several bullets and almost died. It was a long time before Houston was well again. The war ended before he could return to action. After several years as a peacetime soldier, the young officer received special orders from Washington, D.C. Some Cherokee chiefs had signed a treaty with the United States. The treaty said that all Cherokees must move west to an area across the Mississippi River.
Uluteka, with whom Houston had lived, was not one of the chiefs who signed the treaty. He could not understand why he should honor the agreement. Houston's job was to get Uluteka to accept the treaty. Houston did not want to do this. He believed it was wrong. However, he also knew it was a soldier's duty to obey orders. The Cherokees were glad to see Sam return, but they were sad when they learned why he had come. After much talk, Uluteka finally agreed to leave the land. Houston had done his duty, but he was not pleased. Because of this and other reasons, he left the army when he was 25 years old.
Sam Houston decided to become a lawyer. He went to Nashville, the capital of Tennessee, to study law. Houston completed 18 months of study in just 6 months. He surprised everyone by passing the test required to become a lawyer. He opened a law office in a town near Nashville. Former General Andrew Jackson lived near the city, and Houston visited him often. They became close friends. Jackson was the political leader of Tennessee. He urged his young friend to enter politics. Houston accepted this invitation. Jackson's support meant much to a political candidate in Tennessee. Houston was elected to the United States House of Representatives. He served in Congress for 4 years. Then Andrew Jackson was elected President of the United States, and Houston was elected Governor of Tennessee. Houston had worked hard for Jackson. Many people believed that Houston would follow Jackson as president.
But Houston had something else on his mind, a young woman. She was Eliza Allen, the daughter of a friend. They decided to marry. For several months, they seemed happy. Then something happened. Eliza left Sam and returned home. Houston never explained the reason for the break between them. He said only that it was painful and private. Houston resigned as governor and left Tennessee.
Sam Houston traveled to Arkansas, where the Cherokee Indians were living. Chief Uluteka welcomed him warmly. Houston attempted to forget his sadness by working hard. But work did not make him forget. Houston drank too much alcohol and was drunk for months. Then he got a letter telling him his mother was sick. Houston went home. Before she died, Mrs. Houston told her son that she was sure of his strength and that he would succeed in life.
Houston had received a letter from a group of New York City bankers. They wanted him to go to the western area called Texas. Houston liked this idea. Many Americans had been moving to Texas for the past few years. The area was then part of Mexico. However, the Mexican government had opened the area to Americans who wished to live there. Houston talked to the bankers, but got no immediate decision from them. He went to Washington to see President Jackson. The president offered him a job. He asked his friend to go to Texas to negotiate peace with the Comanche Indians.
Houston moved to Texas in 1832. He met with the Indians. The talks were successful, and the Indians agreed to have peace. People told him that a spirit of rebellion was spreading across Texas. The Mexican government had made a number of laws that the Texans did not believe were fair. Houston went to San Felipe de Austin, the capital of a colony of Americans. Stephen Austin had started the colony with Mexico's permission and worked hard to make it a success. Austin feared that Houston had come to lead a struggle against Mexico. Austin did not believe that a war was necessary. He thought new leaders would come to power in Mexico. He believed they would make changes in the laws. Austin was partly right. The Mexican dictator, Anastasio Bustamante, was ousted. General Antonio López de Santa Anna seized power.
The Texans called a meeting to write a letter to Santa Anna. They asked him to change the cruel laws ordered by Bustamante. Austin agreed to carry the letter to the new Mexican leader. Months after Austin left, the Texans learned that he had been arrested in Mexico City and put in prison. They now felt that Santa Anna was no better than Bustamante. Finally, the Mexican leader freed Austin and let him return to Texas. Austin now believed that peaceful methods would not help the Texans.
The Texans held another meeting. There was a deep split among the delegates. Many believed the only answer was complete independence from Mexico. Others believed Texas should fight for a democratic Mexican government. After much debate, the delegates decided to try to keep Texas a Mexican state. They quickly wrote a new state constitution and agreed to meet again. A temporary governor was elected. Sam Houston was chosen commander-in-chief of the Texas Army. There was little time to get an army ready. Santa Anna's forces already were in Texas, in San Antonio. A group of Texas volunteer soldiers wanted to go to San Antonio to fight the Mexicans. Houston opposed this idea. He believed the soldiers needed more training. However, the volunteer soldiers left for San Antonio. There was a violent 5-day battle. The small Texas force won a surprise victory.
Most Texans believed the war had been won, but Houston knew Santa Anna would not give up Texas so easily. Houston continued to build an army.
Several Texas officers formed a small army and planned to attack Mexico without Houston's permission. He believed the planned attack on Mexico was wrong, so he resigned. But before he did, he ordered Texans in San Antonio to destroy the old Spanish fort called the Alamo. Houston did not think the Alamo could be defended against a strong Mexican attack. Steve Ember and Phoebe Zimmerman will be back next Sunday to bring you that part of the story right here on As It Is. And that's our program for today. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington.